going to be talking about college admissions and scholarships. My name is Lee Dins, and I'm the home scholar, booth number 4, for those of you that want to come and see me. Again, this topic does come from this book, College Admissions and Scholarships, and I'll be giving you an overview, 1-hour class, and I'll give you a couple sentences about each chapter that's in here, so that you feel like at least you have a plan, right? Moving forward, you're going to need this plan. Now, the topic is college admission and scholarship. So I would like you to raise your hand if you are interested in scholarship money for your children. Okay, because if you are not, this is the wrong class. You might as well go somewhere else, because most of the things I talk about are for people that cannot otherwise afford college. And let me give you the helpful hints, not the cheaty ways, the helpful hints to get you into college with good scholarships. Okay, because I was very concerned about that, not having enough saved up myself, right? This class is going to help you find that zone, right? The sweet spot between I'm totally relaxed and I'm totally uptight and nervous, okay? We're going to try to find that perfect place between panic paranoia and I am relaxed and laissez-faire, all right? The zone is where you are relaxed, calm, but at the same time you're engaged. It's very difficult to be disengaged and get your children into the college that they want and get scholarships that you need. Occasionally, I will see teenagers that are so motivated that they can really move the ball forward. Even in those situations, the teenager is often not aware of your financial position and does not care about scholarships because daddy has always paid for everything, and why would this be any different, right? They don't have a clue. And so it really will help you to be engaged in the process, but you do have to be relaxed enough to not panic, all right? So that's the sweet spot that we're looking for. Now, I will say that as long as you can remain engaged, that means you don't drop the ball, okay? As long as you don't drop the ball, the chances of getting scholarships are very, very good. And normal scholarships will happen to normal families all the time. And I wanted to tell you this one story about Michelle and her son. She was writing to me afterwards because she felt like it had been so surprisingly successful in her life. She said, you know, his SAT score was good, but it was only good. It wasn't great. It wasn't a top score at any college. He didn't do well on some AP tests, although he knew he needed some AP tests, which, you know, is a step in the right direction. His scores weren't very good on that. But she had provided each college with comprehensive homeschool records that had the transcript, the course descriptions, the reading list. And she had done all of those things that I'm going to be teaching you about today. And when she submitted these materials to the admission office, they said that it was one of the very best scholarship entries that they had ever seen. And the academic scholarships at the different colleges that he was applying to ranged between $24,000 and $60,000. This is from a normal child with normal SAT scores, for a mom that really was engaged in the process and did not drop the ball, okay? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Now, I have shared earlier that if you do work the process like we're going to be talking about today, it does take some time. It's not super hard. If you've taught your children to write a fifth grade essay, you can do the things that I'm teaching you today. So it's not really hard, but at the same time, there is a huge payoff. Let's think about Michelle's scholarship, for example. That's $60,000 in scholarships. That was money she didn't have. If she hadn't have gotten the scholarships, if she wanted her child to go to college, she would have had to cough up another $60,000. So let's raise your hand if you have $60,000 in your pocket, right? Not so much. So you really want to remain engaged in the process. Okay, so what we're going to be talking about today is preparing for college, finding a college, applying for college, getting scholarships, facing the reality of your home, and finding resources. So we're going to be talking about each one of those in detail so that you're going to feel like you have a grip on what it is that's expected of you. Okay? First of all, you want to be planning high school courses. That means planning a rigorous curriculum. I'll give you the little key on rigorous curriculum. That means that you're keeping your child challenged, but not overwhelmed. This is very important. If you have a gifted child, you keep shoveling it in because you want to keep them challenged. If you have a child that has some learning challenges, you have to make sure that your curriculum does not overwhelm them, or they won't learn as much. All right? So you're keeping them challenged but not overwhelmed. At the same time, you want to look at the planning guide that I've provided on your handout today and refer back to it at least once a year and ask yourself, am I on task? Am I going to be able to have all the math classes that they need, all the foreign language that they need? And you keep looking at that. Now here's the key. If you want to get big scholarships, you want to exceed expectations when you can. Now, the temptation is to look at math, say, and say, my goodness, there's no way, I've already dropped the ball, I can't possibly do math. Well, that's probably not where you're going to be exceeding expectations anyway. Probably you'll exceed expectations somewhere else. And you may exceed expectations in art or history or English, but you don't have to exceed expectations across the board, okay? So you have to remember the strengths of your child and not just the weaknesses that you're facing, all right? Okay, so we want to be looking for at least 4 years of English. Now that means reading and writing, and it can be as hard or as easy as it needs to be in order to be challenging but not overwhelming. For some children, that's going to be paragraph structure, writing a 500-word essay by the time they graduate. For other kids, it's going to be writing 25,000-word essays, right? It varies dramatically. You don't have to teach everything under the sun. You certainly don't have to teach it every year. But you want to keep them challenged, and you want to have 4 years of high school English. How do you exceed expectations in English, right? You're already teaching 4 years. That's 1 year. How do you exceed expectations? Well, one way is when your child loves it, and they're doing English for fun, when you're not looking. Yes, to the point of annoyance. Will you stop writing in your journal and please go out and play, right? So sometimes a child will, don't laugh, sometimes a child will write a novel when you're not looking, or they will publish something when you're not looking, and that is one way to exceed expectations. With all of these planning courses, you'll notice that if you do a class at a community college, it goes twice as fast. And if they took 2 English classes when they were in community college, they would have 2 English classes on their transcript, and that is another way to exceed expectations. Colleges want to see 4 years of high school math. You want to keep them challenged but not overwhelmed. I will tell you a quick story. I was getting my hair cut one day, and this mom was saying, oh, the public school is doing such a terrible job. They have such a horrible guidance counselor. I told them that he was getting a D in pre-algebra, and I didn't want him to go into algebra, but he made me. She said, the next fall, I said he was a basket case. He was crying. 2 weeks into the class, he came to me and said, Mom, I can't take it. I don't even know what the symbols mean on the board. It's awful, Mom. Help me. She went in and she talked to the guidance counselor, and that's when she found out that they had accidentally placed him in calculus instead of algebra, okay? So I know that we sometimes feel insecure about our class choices, right? But let's get real. We were never, ever going to make that mistake. We're scared enough of calculus as it is. So you want to keep your children challenged in math but not overwhelmed. The farther they can get in math, the better off you're all going to be. How are you going to exceed expectations? One way is that if your child did Algebra 1 before high school, is to put that on their high school transcript as an early high school credit. For some kids that are quite bright in math, this is going to be their area, right, where they exceed expectations. They might have Algebra 1 in 8th grade and Geometry in 9th grade, and then all of a sudden they have one extra credit, okay? So that's how you do that in math. For social studies, colleges want to see 3 or 4 years of social sciences. And usually that is U.S. history, world history, economics for a half a credit, and government for a half a credit. So an easy way to exceed expectations is to give them a whole credit in economics or a whole credit in government and just do a bigger curriculum than the minimum requirement. Another way you can exceed expectations is by letting them study a subject that they really enjoy. I've mentioned earlier that one of my children studied economics for 3 years, right? That was not a requirement. He was definitely exceeding expectations. I have very prolific readers. My other son read a lot about Russian history, so I made sure to put Russian history as a social studies class that he had done. There's other kinds of classes that you can do for fun that might be enjoyable for your children to exceed expectations. Psychology is one. There's lots of different, geography is another social science that will teach them different things about the way people groups move. And so that will help them to exceed expectations. Colleges like to see 3 years of science and at least one lab. The way to exceed expectations then is what homeschoolers tend to do anyway, which is teach a lab science each time they teach science. We just do it kind of without thinking. Another thing is to just sort of get in the back of your brain that, you know, it's just sort of like reading in math. We make them do it every year without thinking, right? And then all of a sudden you have 4 years of science with 4 labs, and that is exceeding expectations. The other thing is, if your child has done high school level biology as a 7th or 8th grader, that gets put onto the high school transcript as an early high school credit, and that is another way to exceed expectations. For foreign languages, colleges want to see 2, 3, or 4 years of a single foreign language. Now, I know that it's very popular for homeschoolers to teach their children Latin when they're younger and then move on to a different modern language later on. If that happens to be you, and you are using a high school level Latin curriculum, you can put that on your transcript as an early high school credit. For example, I like to say I taught my children Latin, not so much. My children learned Latin using the Latin Road to English Grammar. I put that right there on their high school transcript, even though they did it in middle school. Okay, that was how we were able to exceed expectations. For PE, colleges want to see 2 full credits of PE, 2 full years of PE. But if your children are physically fit, they're involved in sports, and you put that as their PE class, then you'll be exceeding expectations. They might end up having a PE credit each year. I'll be talking about this at another session about how do you determine a credit. But basically, for things like PE, where you're counting hours, a high school credit is between 120 to 180 hours, and that determines one whole high school class. So here's the thing. If you have an athlete, they can do 180 hours of their sport in the blink of an eye, right? We were involved in swim team, and I mean, it was 300 hours every summer. It was crazy. So it's a pretty easy way for somebody to exceed expectations. Maybe they're meeting expectations in math and science, but exceeding expectations in other areas like their PE area. For fine art, colleges want to see 1 year of fine art, which some people, like me, are very relieved about because I found the fine arts very hard to master. But for other people, it is an easy way for them to exceed expectations. Maybe they're involved in homeschool choir and they take piano, and those are 2 credits that they earn every single year. So you can exceed expectations in the fine arts. If your child is taking piano lessons and the teacher makes them practice for 45 minutes or an hour a day, that's one whole credit that your child is getting every single year that you make them take piano lessons. And now is a good time to review that if they were in public school, it would be seat time, 180 hours. And so what you're looking at is how much are they supposed to be practicing, okay? So just to keep that one real. All right, and then for electives, you want to make sure that your child has at least 24 total credits. So it's however many electives it's going to take, so you have at least 24 credits. So to exceed expectations then, you're looking at things that they do for fun. Is it academic? Can I put that on the transcript? Is this summer school? Can I put that on the transcript? Everything that they've done with their dual enrollment at the community college, you make sure you put that on the transcript, and that's how you can exceed expectations. Having 24 credits as a homeschooler, it sounds hard when your children are freshmen, but really that only means that they've taken 6 classes a year. A lot of homeschoolers are a lot meaner than that. I mean, it's pretty common for parents to have their children do more than that or do some independent study over the summer, or next thing you know, they're in community college and they're racking up credits left and right. So having more credits than that is actually very possible. Okay, so when you're thinking about the electives, just remember that your feelings of annoyance for the things that your child does can indicate that specialization or passion. That's what colleges call it, passion. They're looking for passion. Something that the child does and is driven to do because of something that comes inside of their heart, which is, of course, why we find it so annoying, right? So they're looking for this passion, and when we put it on the transcript, we feel, you know, possibly annoyed because of all of these things that were annoying the whole time that they did it. And yet, that really demonstrates a strength. So a classic example is somebody that has so many art credits, right? And the mom is thinking, I can't get her to do math, I can't get her to do science. All she does is sing, play the violin, and play the piano. Would she ever knock it off? But if you're talking about 12 credits of fine art, that is a strength. That is a passion. And showing that on your homeschool transcript is going to demonstrate exactly the wonderful things about your child. The other thing that showing their passion demonstrates is why they don't have strengths in other areas, right? Why don't they have more credits in math? Well, usually the kids that are good in art aren't as good at math, right? So when they see all of these credits for art, they're going to go, oh, now I understand. That's why we got to Algebra 2 instead of pre-calculus or whatever. And it shows that balance. So specialization means classes on the transcript. Sometimes you can exceed their expectations if they really, truly love a subject by having them take a college-level test in that subject. And that's what a CLEP exam is, C-L-E-P. You can get more information from collegeboard.org. They have many college-level tests in economics and history and sciences and foreign languages. So if your child really, really likes something, then you can often find extra college-level credits by having them take CLEP exam. This is especially true if you have a prolific reader. I don't know how many of you do, but those prolific readers, they can absorb things that you had no idea they were even learning. And so giving them a CLEP exam at home can indicate, you know, oh, I didn't know they were learning that, but I need to put that on their high school transcript, okay? Now, I know that sounds a little funny, and parents of seventh graders are saying that my child is never going to be smart enough to learn college-level material in high school, But I promise you that it can, in fact, happen to normal kids, especially when they like to read a lot. Okay, so it will also be that annoyance and that passion that also can indicate things that you can list on their activity list, all right? Now, I know that a lot of parents are concerned about double dipping, and double dipping is not allowed. You can't have 180 hours and call it this class and that class at the same time, all right? But a class can be an activity. Let's think back to when I was in high school, which wasn't that long ago, and I was involved in choir, and every year my transcript said choir. It wasn't different, just choir, 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 every year. And every year, Bellevue High School Choir was listed as my activity, all right? So my friends would be involved in choir and band and orchestra. Every year it was on their transcript. Every year it was on their activity list. It's okay to have it on the transcript and activity list. Dipping is when you're calling the same chunk of hours two different classes at the same time, okay? Now, you're looking for some uniqueness, and how do you convey uniqueness in your high school? And one way is to show these credits that you have put honestly on your transcript because you know you're a mean mom, and you do summer school, and you made them do too much, much more than a lot of other people do. You know who you are, okay? The other thing that it will do, though, is demonstrate the uniqueness of your child. And so if you have all of these PE credits, and it also shows that he's on the football team, the baseball team, he swims competitively, they're going to look at that transcript and say, yeah, that looks really real, because the activity list matches the transcript. And so they can see exactly where that overlap is. And remember, too, that when they're developing their passion, colleges want to see something that they have loved for 4 years straight. And the reason for that is they want to know that you'll love that college for 4 years straight. Okay? So you want to put their four-year activities first and then the lesser activities second. Okay, the next thing we're going to talk about is preparing for college, and that involves the high school tests that are quite common. Now, usually the first time people will take one of those tests is in 10th grade, and that's when the child can take the PSAT for fun. Now, the PSAT is like a practice SAT test. It really doesn't count until 11th grade. Most people who take it in 11th grade. But by taking it in 10th, you're giving them a little bit of practice, making it seem like a not scary thing. Anybody can do this. Now, sometimes people will ask me, do I recommend if children take the PSAT in 9th grade? And no, I don't. Sometimes it's appropriate, but usually the child doesn't have enough math, and what I don't want to have happen is you like, I'm going to get all college prep, but I'm going to make them take a test in 9th grade that they cannot possibly score well on. That can actually cause some test anxiety, right? So let's think about those tests for a moment. Usually when we give a test, it's like a math test, and we kind of expect them to get 100%. I mean, we didn't teach them this stuff, right? They shouldn't. And they don't. They don't get 100%. But we wish that they would, right? With the PSAT and the SAT and the ACT, it's almost impossible to get 100%. And so when you give them that test too early, they feel that sense of failure. They know they only got half of them right. How does that feel when mom has always told them that they should really try their best and try for 100%? And that's why I don't like giving the PSAT too early. Now, the PSAT in 10th grade, I think, is a great idea. If you're thinking about the high school tests and you're like, well, how do I prepare my 7th grader for a high school test? Here's what you need to know. They cover reading, writing, and math. If you're covering reading, writing, and math, you are golden. Okay. They do have a handwritten essay. Bonus points if you teach penmanship. Okay? A little story about penmanship. It only has to be legible. I think we get all wrapped up in what style we use, right? Doesn't matter. Legible. Legible and speed. That's what matters. Okay? So before that 10th grade, your test prep is teaching, reading, writing, and math. The other thing that you can do is to get them used to taking a fill-in-the-bubble test among 50 of their very closest friends. Okay? So if your homeschool group has a large testing opportunity, maybe every spring you could take the CAT test or something, and you have your children do that, that will give them that opportunity to practice test-taking skills. You know, it's a little weird to take a fill-in-the-bubble test. I mean, let's think about that. It's kind of a weird thing to do. And it's even weirder when you don't know anybody in the room and you don't know where the bathroom is and you don't know the other people that you're in the room with. So it gives them a little bit of practice with that. Okay? So take the PSAT in 10th grade just for fun. All right? The next test that they will experience is taking the PSAT in 11th grade. Now, that's when it can qualify your child for the National Merit Scholarship. Maybe you've heard about that. This is how you get that scholarship, the National Merit Scholarship. So, it begs the question, what is the National Merit Scholarship? Do you wonder how much money it is? Could it be $40,000? Could it be a full tuition scholarship? The National Merit Scholarship is $2,500. It's like zero. It's chump change. It pays for books, right? But the National Merit Scholarship is very impressive to the colleges, and they like National Merit Scholars so much that they brag about it on their brochures, and they'll say, we have 10 National Merit Scholarships, right? Well, if you're the 11th, they would love you. So, yeah, the National Merit Scholarship is $2,500, but it's still worth pursuing, okay? If your child has tended to score in the 90th percentile or above, have them study for the PSAT in 11th grade. They won't get frustrated because they already are pretty ahead. They'll probably be able to study and do quite well. And so if your child is like on average, just an average child, I usually say the PSAT in 11th grade is the starting pistol for test preparation. But if your child really needs scholarships or all hope is lost of college, and if your child tends to score quite well and is just on the cusp of the 97th percentile, then have them use the 10th grade PSAT that's normally for fun and say, that's the starting pistol. We're starting our test preparation now. Now, many colleges will give you set scholarships based on your SAT scores almost exclusively. There are a lot of colleges that will say right on their website, if you get this score, I give you $10,000. If you get this score, I give you $15,000. So when you think about it, your child doesn't even have to get a perfect score. They only need to go up the next level in order to get $5,000 more per year, which, by the way, I would love to make more than $5,000 more per year. You know what I'm saying? So it's like real money that really counts. So you want to be studying for the test. Remember that you don't have to get a perfect score. All you have to do is do better than the other people around you. Better than you would have done without test preparation, okay? So you take the 11th grade PSAT in October, and that's when you have that PSAT. I'll take questions at the end this time. Okay. And then in the spring of 11th grade, that's when you want to take either the SAT or the ACT test. Spring of 11th grade. Now, I will give you a little hint. I prefer it when people take it in March. That gives them a nice long time in junior year to be studying a lot. They'll take the test in March, but it still gives you enough time to take it a second time in June if you feel like you can increase your score, if you can convince your child to study some more. Okay? So taking the SAT or PSAT in March of junior year and repeat it in June of junior year. I think it's a very good idea to take the test twice. Many colleges encourage you to take it twice. I don't think it's necessary to take it more than that, unless it's really going to benefit you for some reason. So when you're choosing between the SAT and the ACT, I mentioned this in the previous class, but colleges will take either one, and they know how to convert an SAT score into an ACT score. So even if their website says, for an SAT score of this, I'll give you $10,000, if you give them an ACT, they know how to make the math work to give you the scholarship money that they want to give you. Okay? So a big tip to getting big scholarships is to make sure that you give the test that makes your child look smarter. All right? You get a sample SAT, a sample ACT, have them take it at home in timed situations, which, oh, they love that. There's nothing like a four-hour test at home, right? But hey, son, it's worth it for the money. And then you compare to see which test gave them the higher percentile ranking, and you give them the test that makes them look smarter, all right? So they're going to be studying for the SAT or the ACT. Now, general studies preparation for the test, it's easiest, it's cheapest, it's most effective if you just buy real tests from the SAT group, okay? You can get it either at collegeboard.org, you can get them on Amazon. I prefer the Princeton Review materials. I think it's written a little bit easier. They have the book called The 10 Real SATs. They have one for the ACT test as well. So the easiest way is to buy the book and convince your child to do one section of the test each day in a timed situation. Now, each section is only 25 minutes long. And to review, it covers reading, writing, and math. And of all the things we want for our children, you know, you've got your breathing, right? But then reading, writing, and math, it's right up there. So when they're doing these test prep skills, they're learning their vocabulary, the grammar, the analysis, all of those editing, all of those things that we want them to learn anyway. And so what you want to do is replace your normal homeschool curriculum with this SAT prep material. This is why children love me. I just told you to work them less hard, didn't I? Okay, so you don't have to get a separate grammar curriculum. It's in the test. You don't have to get a separate vocabulary curriculum. It's in the test. You don't even have to teach them to write a quick essay because the quick essay is in the test, right? So all this test preparation will help them, and it also becomes part of their English credit, so you can include those things that you use in your course description for English. Okay, so that's one method of studying for the SAT, is to make sure that you have one section a day, and you do that, you know, you're really hoping for 5 days a week. Let's get real, 3 to 5 days a week, okay? I've also been doing a lot of research recently that shows that it's the SAT or ACT is a lot like running a marathon, and you need to get conditioned and trained to run this marathon. And that means that you give them a full-length practice test about every week. I'm not sure I could have talked my children into it, but I'm just throwing that idea out there in case you have more compliant children than me. But I do think it would be a great idea, if you had compliant children, to give them a full-length practice test once a week during that heavy, we're going to score well so you can go to college days, okay? All right. Now, we've talked about some of these tests, but I want to back up just a little bit and talk about how junior year is absolutely critical, because junior year has specific steps that you have to go through in order to get the big scholarships, all right? Now, we've already mentioned two. One is to take the PSAT in the fall and to start studying, I guess it's three, and to take the SAT or ACT in the spring. But in the midst of all of this work that you're doing, having thrown out your English program because you're now doing short essays and all of that SAT prep. In the midst of all that, you also want to be finding a college. Junior year is the year when you look for and find a college. It's not like falling off a log. There are certain things that you have to go through. The easiest way to start the process is to go to a college fair. Now, college fairs are an awful lot like homeschool fairs, except instead of having English curriculum, each college has its own booth. And instead of you going to visit 100 colleges are coming to see you, right? So it's very cost effective, and it sure beats traveling around the country. And so you want to be looking at each of the booths at the college fair. When you're doing that, you're going to be looking not just at the college, but why do you like them or not like them? And that will tell you a lot about your teenager, because if they always go to the college that has, you know, a huge population, they probably want a bigger school. Or if your child is always drawn to that college table that has the small Christian schools, that's going to tell you a lot of information. When you're at the college fair, I encourage you, for biggest scholarships, to let your child speak first. They take secret notes on you at a college, and they're looking to see if there's somebody inside of those eyes with that student, right? Can they really perform at college? Are they really engaged? Or is this something that mom or dad is just making them do? So by having your child speak first, that can kind of pre-disaster that situation, all right? So what will help is if your child has already decided, what are the two questions I always ask so I don't even have to think about it? And you just plan ahead for those two questions. A lot of times it's very simple to start off with what you like. I really like theater. And then tie it into, what do you think I should do, right? I really like economics. What sort of major do you have at your college that you think I would enjoy? Okay, so this is what I like. What do you think? All right. Another thing that you can do is to ask them specific questions about college life itself. So the child may say, tell me something about your college that makes them different from someone else. Now the second person to speak is you as the parent. Now the things that the parent might say at a college fair usually boils down to two things. What do you need from me as a homeschooler, and how do I get big scholarships? All right? They're used to those questions from homeschool parents. It's okay to ask about scholarships. They know that it's our pocketbook, and they're okay with that, right? They will give you the most remarkable tips. I asked one college, what do you want from homeschoolers? And they said, I really want some students that know lacrosse. It's like, really? Of all the things, that's what you're going to ask me for, you know, lacrosse. But if you wanted to go to that college and you had asked that question, you would have darn learned lacrosse, wouldn't you? Right? And that would have gotten you in. So you want to be asking those questions. When you go to a college fair, it is extremely helpful if you can bring a copy of your transcript and maybe a couple of course descriptions. And you can say, I am a homeschool parent. I have prepared course descriptions like this. Is this the kind of information that you like? All right? First of all, that will help you modify what it is you're doing. Maybe they'll say, we want more. Maybe they'll say, we're not interested, but you can submit it if you want to, and you'll be able to modify whatever. I need more information. I only need information on math. Whatever. You're going to give it to them. But the other thing that it's going to do, it's going to show them that you're that kind of mom, right? You want to be that kind of mom that actually teaches their child the tough stuff, all right? I know that there's a lot of homeschool parents that are very, very engaged and driven, but I also know that there are homeschool parents that are very laissez-faire, very laid back, or have had tremendous crisis in their home. And so this can kind of show that no matter what you've been going through, this is our homeschool. We are a strong, vibrant academic community, all right? Okay, so you're going to be showing them your homeschool record so that they can give feedback, and that is what happens in the fall. During the winter of junior year, you're going to take all of those colleges that you're sort of interested in. Hopefully, you've pared it way down from 300. And now you have only 25 that maybe, you know, we'll find out. We'll see. That's when you start doing research on those specific colleges. There is a book that is about 800 pages long with every detail you could ever want to know about colleges. And the great news is you do not have to read all 800 pages. You only have to read the 25 pages that you need, right? Only the pages about the colleges you're interested in. It's like reading the yellow pages. Nobody does that cover to cover. You only read about the plumber when you need the plumber, okay? So when you're doing that research, you make sure to read every single word about the colleges that you're interested in. Some of those words are pretty shocking. If those words say, our employment rate at graduation is 67%, you may be thinking, that would not be a good investment of $60,000 if they can't get employed at the end, okay? Or if your child wants to go into medical school, and one college says, we have a 67% admit rate to medical school, and another college says, we have a 98% admission rate to medical school, you want to know that, all right? There is one statistic in there that tells you how long it takes the average child to graduate. Yeah, so like one of our state schools, on average, it takes children 6 years to graduate. So it really doesn't matter how cheap that public university is if you have to pay for 6 years instead of four, all right? So you want to know every single detail. After you've done your research, that's when you're thinking about, okay, I have in mind now there are some colleges that we need to visit. And spring of junior year is when you start your college visits. College visits are incredibly important. First of all, it can eliminate some really horrendous and inappropriate colleges from your list that you have no idea would not be a good idea. The second thing is it will give you fodder for your application essays. Colleges will ask your child to write an essay about themselves, about their goals. They're used to seeing very generic, frankly, poorly written essays. What would happen if you taught your child how to write A? Wouldn't that be cool? Second of all, if you can teach them to include words and phrases that make the college think you love them, they will be more likely to give you scholarship money. During your visits, you take notes on the college. You write down the classes that you visited, the name of the professor, the content of the class, how good was the food, everything you can think of about that visit. Then when you're writing your application essay, you can name drop, right? Wherever it is, and it's more than just name dropping, it's getting into, I like your college because, and you fit that into the context of the application essay, okay? When you're writing an application essay, those take a lot of time and effort. So the more research you can do during your college visit, the better off you're all going to be. Now, when we were visiting colleges, I was pretty shocked. I had heard that it was important to visit colleges, and I did it because I was told to, right? I'm pretty compliant too, just like my children. But I was really surprised. There were three colleges that we visited that were extremely similar on paper, extremely similar in their statistics. Everything about them was about the same. They offered the same sort of things. They were all in the Seattle area. They were all small Christian schools. And it was really surprising. One of the colleges had such a bureaucracy that they couldn't even allow my children to take a class because they had lost their class pass to get into a presentation. And they couldn't even just let them go, even though it was their fault for losing that. They had so many rules and regulations that they had expectations of my children that they kept asking them over and over again, we mentioned that they swim in summer, right? Summer swim league. My children were not interested in swimming at all in college, and that was all that those people talked about the entire time was, let's get you into swim team. The other college that we visited was where my husband had gone when he was in college, and he thought it would be a certain way, but they had decided that they were no longer going to use the chapel, and they put a big sign over the chapel, and each whatever month the sign would be different based on the theatrical performance that they were doing. And I cannot tell you the name of the theatrical performance because I don't use that language in public, but I will say that that word was right up there, front and center, obliterating the word chapel. We were reading the school newspaper, and they were using the foulest language in the school paper. My husband wrote to them to complain, and it was filtered by Boeing. The language was so bad. So it was all very upsetting to us. It was especially distressing for my husband because that is where he had gone. And that was when we realized that maybe it was a Christian school before, but it isn't so much now. That was a school that had Healthy Bodies Week, which is where they had Planned Parenthood demonstrations right next to the chapel, which I found very interesting. And when we went to the third college that week, they were also celebrating Healthy Body Week. And I could not believe I was exposing my voice to this, right? But we went there, and it was shocking because their Healthy Bodies Week was actually about healthy bodies. They were teaching nutrition and fitness and body image and, you know, girls, be careful, you don't want to get bulimia, you know, all of this stuff that was, like, healthy. And that was when we started to realize the difference between colleges. Statistics were the same, location was the same, the degrees that they offered was the same. The visit was absolutely critical, okay? The example that I normally give is that my children went to Seattle Pacific University. Love the school, by the way. The top unparty school in Washington. Woo! But the top party school in the nation, as rated by Playboy magazine, is usually Texas Christian University. Now, you know, here we are in California. Who knew, right? You wouldn't know. You would think, oh, Christian University, let's apply. That's why you really have to visit. You really don't know. Okay, so in spring, that's when you're visiting these colleges, you're taking notes, and then at the end of spring of junior year, that's when you decide where you're going to apply. I'm going to apply to these schools. Now, on average, students will apply to 4 to 8 universities. That seems to be the sweet spot, all right? Each university may have different requirements and have different essay topics, different deadlines, and you want to know. So by the end of junior year, you have your list of colleges, you know those due dates, and you have your plan. You filled in, you know, oh my gosh, they need SAT subject tests. I'm going to do that real quick junior year because you've done your research junior year and you know that you can get that job done. Okay? So, the reason that you go through all that in junior year is because the biggest way to get college admission and scholarships is by applying early in senior year. A lot of times people will think when you're applying to college that you apply right before you go and you just show up and all the money shows up, right? And that's not how it works. It actually works by applying a year before you're going to go, all right? So if you hear nothing else, I want you to make sure that you apply for college before Thanksgiving. Before Thanksgiving, a senior year. Now, some of them have deadlines that are earlier, but in general, apply before Thanksgiving. The people that read your application, they are like real people. Nice people, generally, or they wouldn't have that job. They often are young people with young families. They often are up all night with screaming babies. Raise your hand if you can relate. Okay. For that reason, they are more likely to like you and give you scholarship money if they are well-rested and not overworked. Before Thanksgiving, they may get 10, 15 applications every day. That's a reasonable workload. Everybody in high school works on their applications over Thanksgiving weekend, and they all start pouring in after that. They might get 500 a day. They might get 1,000 a day. Their wife is crying. The baby's crying. The husband is crying. They don't like you as much when they're crying. Okay. So you want to make sure to apply early before Thanksgiving. Another very important thing is to remember that you have to apply for both public and private universities. Right? Let's dissect the cash on that. Let's say, for example, you live in California. How is that California state budget going for you? Okay. I don't know if they have so much money to give you in scholarships, ladies and gentlemen. I think pretty much the amount you're paying for a University of California school is pretty much the amount that's on the page. You almost pay sticker price, right? The private schools, on the other hand, have you looked at their campuses? Are they well-funded or what? Do they have Bill Gates funding them? Why, yes, they do. Do they get funding from the entire Silicon Valley? Why, yes, in fact, they do. They have a lot of money to give away. So yeah, sure, their sticker price is $40,000, but the average amount of scholarships is $25,000. Generally speaking, on average, for your usual child, the cost of public university and private university is exactly the same, okay? For your average child, not for your super smart child, but just for Joe homeschool kid. Okay. So you want to make sure that you're applying for both, all right? Because the private schools won't be able to give you the money. Almost nobody pays sticker price for public school. Don't let it scare you. When you're doing your research, one of those statistics that you're going to be reading is, on average, what does the average student get in financial aid? And you're going to be saying to yourself, average is in the 50th percentile. What percentile is my son in, my daughter in, will he be getting about that or better, right? And that's how you kind of estimate your cost. All right. The other way that they give scholarship money is by knowing not only your SAT and your ACT scores, but also your GPA. Now let's think about that for a minute. Who gives the grade in your homeschool? Usually, it's mommy or daddy, okay? That's fine, because you'll have SAT or ACT scores, and you have the GPA, and when you look at them side by side, they will usually match up pretty well. Colleges want you to give grades. If you have a good SAT score, they want you to come to their college, because they want your SAT score to raise the value of their college as a whole. And so what they're going to be looking at then is your GPA. And if you can say, I have a great SAT score and a good GPA, they can use both of those statistics to raise the value of their college. It's sort of like the stock market. All of these colleges are just businesses, and their businesses are rated by different things that increase or decrease like the stock market does. And they're rated on SAT, ACT scores. They're rated on GPA. They're also rated on who stays for 4 years, which is why you want to show them that they'll stay for 4 years and love it, right? So all of those things can help. All right, in junior year, you need to make sure that your records are completely and totally up to date and done, because when you apply senior year, they have to be all ready to go. I don't want anybody here calling me on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock saying, I haven't started my course descriptions. Make sure that you get it all done now so that you're all ready to go. If you're freaking out right now and you have a senior that's coming up, say, September, all you have to do is get your transcript and your course descriptions done now during the summer so it's all ready to go. Okay. So we talked about applying to college, and I wanted to mention the application essays, all right? For the teenagers in the group, let me explain to you what an application essay is. It's a selfie, all right? You know how you take a selfie in all these cool situations, and you're trying not to get the same selfie twice because you want to look cool, right? So you get the one swimming, and then you get the one skiing, and get the other one with the famous person, okay? That's what the application essay is like. All three of those selfies should look completely different to make you look cool. So here's how it went in my family. I have the geeky, nerdy types, right? One who loves economics and government. So I had to lay down the law. You are allowed to use the word Thomas Jefferson in only one essay. That's it, son. I don't care how much you beg. Thomas Jefferson, one essay, right? The other essays had to talk about something else in his life that did not involve Thomas Jefferson. So when you're thinking about the essay, the easiest way is to look at the topic and then brainstorm different ideas. What you'll find out in the process of brainstorming these topics for eight colleges that all want three essays is that those essay topics are so similar. There is so much overlap. It's not unusual to be able to use the same essay over and over and over if you choose carefully what your topic is. But each topic should only be used in one essay. And you don't repeat anything. You don't even repeat things that are on the transcript. So you don't say, here's what my GPA is, here's what my SAT scores, and I've taken five art classes. You don't say that. That's all in your transcript. Instead, you paint a portrait or take a selfie of you doing something cool, right? Now, here's a tip to get big scholarships. I call it the gasping grandma tip, all right? You want to start your application essay with a story that makes grandma gasp, all right? It's something that when you told grandma, she said, oh, really? All right? That's the, now, it does not make grandma blush. This is the bad part. It makes grandma gasp. So, for example, if your parent has had a serious life-threatening illness, you would start your essay talking about that moment in time when you as the teenager were there in the hospital and how shocking that was. Or your second essay would be about how there I was in the wilderness and there was a lightning storm and I had to crouch in the lightning position for an hour. And you talk about the feelings and you talk about how you weren't sure and all that thing that was going on. So each of your essays never repeats anything. And the hook is the story about that content that makes grandma gasp, okay? To be quite honest, that's one of the things I enjoy the most about the Gold Care Club consultations, because I can talk to people and say, well, tell me about yourself. And usually the teenager will say something, and mom is like, oh, don't tell her that. And I'm like, oh, that's it, grandma gasped, you know? And so you're looking for stories like that. If you get confused and you need a little help, talk to grandma and say, grandma, what do you think about these topics? And you remember when this happened, and you're looking at her face, and you're waiting for her to go, ooh, okay? All right. So that is the application essay. They are long, they are self-reflective, and they are technically perfect. Now, that may not sound intimidating if you have girls, but I'm telling you what, that self-reflective thing, I thought that was going to kill my children. I had boys. Technically perfect means that you want your mom or dad to edit this paper. You want to incorporate their edits, and you'd really like it to be looked at by another adult as well. When you are receiving feedback from parents, you want to only incorporate the feedback that makes sense for the teenager's voice. Because if you change everything and say it the way mom says it, then all of a sudden it's not going to sound like a teenager's essay at all. It's going to sound like mom cheated and wrote the essay for you. Okay? So you incorporate the feedback, but you use your own words. Okay, So I think I've covered everything that I can cover right now. I have just 3 minutes left, but I did want to mention subject tests very quickly. There are some colleges that like subject tests as well as the SAT or ACT. So when you're doing your research and you're finding out about colleges, make sure that you find out what tests do they like. You want to meet their expectations whenever possible, and when it's possible, you want to exceed their expectations. An Ivy League school may say, we require 5 SAT subject tests. You want to know that in advance. You want to provide what they need. But you can also exceed expectations by giving them 5 AP tests instead if you know about it well in advance. Okay? So I guess the goal here is go team, go. Exceed expectations. Remember that your job is to be relaxed but engaged. All right? And not drop the ball. Thanks, guys.